track those things. So when one thing changes, another thing changes.
The gross national product does not allow the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play.
I get really, really deeply, deeply frustrated that there's a generation of young people coming to university every year and they sign up to study economics. And in this country, they take out a big loan and they dedicate 3 years of their life to studying a subject. They think, and what upsets me is some of them say, I read Donut Economics. I was so excited. So I went to university to study economics, but they're teaching me everything that you said was the old way. I've heard that so many times. Mm. We cannot give up on the universities. Young people today, born into polycrisis, I mean, the idea that they would study that old system, it really makes me mad. These are going to be the people who are taking the world through the 21st century. They deserve a mindset so that they can come up with the really challenging policies that lie ahead. I mean, our generation are not giving them the policies, but at least let's give them the mindset of foundations that so that they have even half a chance of creating the kinds of policies that are going to be needed. So we cannot give up on the universities. At the same time, we can't sit and wait for that. That would be deeply irresponsible to say, well, just start with the next generation and let this generation carry on with the same old thinking. My personal approach is to go where the energy is. I am far more energized to keep doing this work if I'm working with people who get it, who are doing it, who've adopted it, and can demonstrate it in practice.
Hello and welcome to Invisible Handcuffs, a podcast that seeks to expose the economic ideology driving our crises and identify ways we can free ourselves from its chains. My name is Katie Shields and I'm a recovering mainstream economist and your host. In this inaugural episode, I'm joined by economist Kate Raworth, author of the best-selling 2017 book, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. In that book, Raworth put forward that the goal for humanity this century should be to move away from endless growth towards thriving within the means of the living planet. But Donut Economics wasn't just about setting a new goal. Raworth, who studied economics at Oxford, was calling to change the discipline of economics, from ending its obsession with GDP to moving away from models that deify markets while ignoring nature and care, to treating individuals as selfish, self-interested profit maximizers. For her research, Raworth drew on the best of heterodox economic thinking, which for me, coming from the mainstream, was a revelation. And it's fair to say it kicked off a movement. In our interview, we talk about the many surprising ways people are picking up and running with its ideas in cities, communities, and businesses around the world. But we also discuss the barriers that people have to overcome, especially in our institutions where mainstream economics is still the language of policymaking. Kate teaches donut economics in the Environmental Studies Department of Oxford University, and she tells of just how hugely popular her courses are and how young people are demanding fresh thinking. Yet head over to the Mainstream Economics Department and you'll certainly not find her book in the reading list. So we discuss the importance of reclaiming economics in the university. And while Kate does say that this is something we must continue to strive for, we also cannot wait for academia to catch up. And so it's also our job to seek ways that we can help people, especially young people, play a role in rewiring our economies now so that they start to work in service of life rather than life working in service of our economies. I then asked Kate if she has advice for our project, and you can listen to hear what she had to say. Whether you've read Donut Economics or not, I hope you will find this interview both informative and inspiring. I certainly did. With that, please join me in welcoming economist Kate Raworth. Welcome, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Looking forward to chatting.
Great. On that, I'd love to just kind of jump right in, if that's okay. It is 9 or almost 10 years since your kind of rallying call to bring economics into the 21st century. So I'm talking about, obviously, the publication of Donut Economics. But looking back sort of over this period, what has surprised you most about the influence or the impact that this book has had around the world?
So first, it's kind of wild to think that it's nearly 10 years. I mean, it's 9 years, right? It came out in April 2017. Mm-hmm. By far, the biggest surprise is that people have picked it up and put it into practice. I never imagined that. And I have to say, thank God I didn't imagine that, because that would have made it intimidating. I'd have never, ever finished writing the book if I thought it was going to become something that was used by town councils and used in companies and used in the fashion industry and taught in schools. And I mean, I would have been overwhelmed by the responsibility to get everything in there and get it right. So it's incredible the way that people have picked it up. And I'm really, really glad I didn't know at the time.
Well, it is incredible. And that's obviously one of the reasons that we've invited you as our first guest, because it was the thing that I picked up, which started me on my sort of journey to wanting to reclaim economics. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm going to ask you just that. Where were you in your economics journey when you picked up Donut Economics?
So I had actually attended a talk that you gave to the Club of Rome way back.
But were you a student? Were you already studying economics? Did you finish? Like, where was this in your life?
I was well past studying. I'd been working as an economic consultant. I had actually just recently gone back to university to do a master's in environmental economics. Quite different though than the kind of the ecological economics that is, you know, an influence for donut economics. And I was kind of at a period, I just had my third child, and I was at a period of kind of feeling like this isn't working, what we're trying to do, and you know, fixing the climate. So I was kind of open to new things, but it was still quite a revelation for me and took me quite a long time. Mm-hmm. I do think I remember, I have to admit, watching you kind of give your talk, thinking, yeah, no way. Yeah, I'd been working with multinational corporations and sort of trying to convince them to do tiny little, you know, take tiny little steps towards their climate goals. So it took me a while. I didn't know maybe at the time how ready I was for it, but I was very, very grateful, because it was for me not just. And we can get into this a little bit more. For me, it was kind of like a best of all the alternatives that you don't get at university, that book. And it really, so it just made me hungry to want to know more about the alternatives that are out there.
That's
great. But
maybe
you can, yeah. So, and we will talk and like the, of what you said, you know, putting into practice, which I think it's so important. And that's where I'd love to go a little bit today, because people are still picking up the book and then they're sort of saying, okay, how can we implement it? So I'd love to get there, but maybe if I can go back a little bit, because our series is about, you know, exploring where and kind of why economics has gone wrong. Economics being still, I think it's fair to say, if not the most influential discipline when it comes to policies, when it comes to decision making. Yeah. And I know that you had also, like I did, studied economics. You studied PPE, for those that don't know, politics, economics and philosophy at Oxford, and the degree that The Guardian has called the degree that runs Britain, because so many prime ministers, chancellors, newspaper editors study it. So, you know, can you kind of talk about, like, what were you hoping for in studying economics? And was there a moment when you realized this is not kind of what I had signed up for? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I didn't. So I went to university in 1990. And I hadn't studied economics at school. I was new to politics and philosophy and economics. So I was on a game of catch up. I was surrounded by people who'd done economics A-level, right? And so at the beginning, I was just trying to catch up and learn and take it all in. And I loved it. I loved the theories, the frameworks. I was absorbing it all, reading the textbook on my summer holiday before going to university. And it was only gradual that I realized that the reasons that I've been drawn to this, I cared about environmental issues. I cared about the hole in the ozone layer. I'd heard about the greenhouse effect on the news in the 1980s. I cared about the hideous famine in Ethiopia in the mid-1980s, the inequalities in the world. I wanted the tools to be part of changing the world in the way that many young people idealistically and brilliantly want to do. And I knew that economics was the mother tongue of public policy. I thought, if I have this tool under my belt, I can help change things. It was gradual, but I realized, for example, I wanted to study environmental issues. There was no paper in Oxford University that you could opt into to study the environment. There was just no option. So the closest I could get was some subject called public economics. And 1 week we studied the kind of classic story of what if a factory is pouring gloop into the river? Should the government tax them or set a quota? That was it. That was the extent of the environmental reach of my degree. And I realized that people could actually go through their entire economics degree at university, not opting into that paper, and actually come out with a degree as an economist, having never touched anything about the living world. We didn't talk about energy. We didn't talk about materials. We didn't talk about environmental degradation. And these were really close to my heart. So I was frustrated that the thing I'd come to the university for was totally missing. Equally, social issues. We would always start conversations about inequality or distribution as saying, taking initial distribution as given. And yet I wanted to talk about human rights and what should be a foundational starting point for people. And the real clincher for me, though, came when I finished my undergraduate degree and I did a master's degree in development economics. And the first question I was asked was, what is human development and how should we best measure it? And I was gripped by this question. It was in the mid-1990s, the UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, had launched the Human Development Report. And in it, there was this index for measuring human development that looks at the life expectancy, literacy rates and school enrollment rates and average income per person and ranks countries in those terms. So it was this concept of human development. But it was the first time, and I was into my fourth year of studying economics, it was the first time that anybody had asked me to reflect on what does success look like. The first 3 years of my economics degree, we never talked about what's the goal, what is success, and how should we measure it, because it was just tacit, it's implicit. It was measured in GDP and the growth of the economy. And that wasn't even the end of the question. We didn't begin by questioning it. We never really talked about that. It was just implicit that economic growth as a result of these policies, and so this is success. So it was when I studied development economics and I studied the work of Amartya Sen, who starts not with the market, but with human capabilities and what every human should have the capability to be part of a, included in a democratic, no, sorry, Sen said every human being should have the capacity to participate in society with dignity. And I was just really struck. Why is it only when we come to studying economics for developing countries that we actually talk about the fundamentals? Surely this is for all economics, for high-income countries or the so-called developed nations, and I began to question that as well. Mm-hmm. Why are we only talking about the philosophical, social, moral foundations? Why are we only talking about goals when we're talking about lower-income countries? This should be applied right where we are. And when we don't talk about it, it doesn't mean it's not there. Right, the economics textbook that I was first told to read was called Positive Economics. And it doesn't mean positive is as in thumbs up, good economics. It means not normative. It's value free. This is objective. I mean, that's complete nonsense. It's not value free. But if you don't express the values, if you don't talk about them, you're just leaving them totally implicit and unrecognized. So I realized that all the economics I'd studied was blind to the fact that it was full of values, but claiming to be value free. And that alarmed me. And so by the end of studying development economics and being surrounded then with people doing development studies, with people doing anthropology, sociology, and they were talking about power and they were talking about all sorts of things were completely missing from my economics degrees. Mm-hmm. I came out of my fourth year of studying economics realizing I never wanted to say, hello, I'm an economist, because I had just become very, very aware of all the dynamics of the world that were missing from the worldview I've been taught, and I was not proud of it.
Yeah, I can really kind of empathize with that. It was a development economics elective that had also made me sort of question right at the end of my bachelor's degree. We're taking it, and it was just a little flinching moment where I thought, oh, wait a minute, some of this is sort of questioning what I've been learning these past few years. But it is kind of, yeah, absurd that you only come into these questions if you take, you know, an elective route and it's not in the core, and still not in the core of much of what is taught. So you mentioned the Human Development Goals. You then went on to actually work with the United Nations Development Programme. So how was your then experience of the real world and compared to what you had learned and what you were seeing in real life working, you know, in development and with so-called developing countries?
So when I left university, my first job was working in Zanzibar. I was posted by the Overseas Development Institute. I was posted to work as a civil servant of the government of Zanzibar in the Ministry of Trade, Industries and Marketing. It was the most phenomenal experience. And I ended up working with craftspeople across the islands, seeing if these people who had basic craft skills that they were making for the local economy, if there was any way they could benefit from the tourism that was, from my point of view, ravaging the islands. I mean, it was such an assault on traditional life there, but a phenomenal source of possible income. So can people in the villages get any benefit from the tourism that's coming? So I worked with craftspeople to see if we could get that opportunity for them. But I learned so much from particularly the women and the women's groups that I sat with. I learned Swahili so I could sit on the mat with them in the village and talk to them and realize that the resilience they had, many brilliant barefoot entrepreneurs who'd literally walk across the island barefoot with beautiful pots on their heads that they'd made, they depended on the forest, on their community for everything. And they made it work. So I saw the commons in practice before I'd ever heard about the commons. I'd only ever heard about the tragedy of the commons because that's what you get taught in economics. And yet I saw thriving commons in practice in these communities. I then went from Zanzibar, from being there for 3 years, to a very, very different island, Manhattan, to work for the United Nations Development Programme on the Human Development Report, which had so influenced me in this first essay I'd written. But then I was also really frustrated there because when we created we had the Human Development Index, which would come out every year and celebrate which country is at the top of the HDI. And again, it's measuring life expectancy, literacy and enrollment rates and average income per person. It's not perfect, but it was much closer to what matters than just the GDP of the country. Countries that were at the top of the HDI in those days were countries like Norway, Australia. And so I remember I had to be part of the communications team when on the day it was announced, I had to go on sort of drive time radio in Australia or in Norway. And I would come on air and I'd be saying, yeah, congratulations, your country's come out top of the HDI. And they'd be saying, yeah, we're the best country in the world. And I'm sitting there thinking, Norway exports oil to the world. Australia has these massive mining projects. These countries have huge environmental footprints, and yet we're telling them they are top of the Human Development Index. They're the most developed, you know, the most successful countries in the world because it makes no mention of the environmental impact. So I became really frustrated that we were celebrating what you're doing for humans, but not taking any account of how you are undermining the living systems of the planet in the process of doing that. And I started to sort of become an internal wrestler and challenger to the HDI. And I know that when I left, I ultimately embodied that into the donut. But it was incredibly helpful to realize, you know, the metrics by which we measure success really matter. Whether it's just GDP of a nation, whether it's just the human aspects, and we need better metrics that make visible everything that we should be taking into account with countries.
So you were at the UN, you went on to Oxfam, and then sort of get to writing donut economics. And one of the things that when you mentioned at the beginning that people are actually implementing this, which is fantastic, and as I am trying to do in my community. And there's a quote that you often say is that you thought that donut economics would be sort of practice first, theorize second. The theory is still there though in the mainstream economics courses. And so I was wondering that did you try to do the theory route first?
So first of all, one of the reasons I wrote donut economics is because after I worked at the UN, I moved to Oxford. I worked for Oxfam. I became a mother of twins, right? So the unpaid caring economy was really presenting itself to me in stereo with twins. And I sat on the sofa in 2007, 2008, and watched the global financial meltdown. So there I am with these two tiny babies and watching all the economists coming on the screen saying, yes, yes, we're going to rewrite economics to make it reflect real financial realities in light of this crisis. And I just remember thinking, oh, really? Are we just going to rewrite economics now just for that? And everything else stays the same. We'll just bring in the real functions of money and banks. No way. And it rallied me to want to come back towards economics. So I started reading all the economics I had never been taught. talking to friends, picking up tidbits. Oh, Herman Daly, what's that? Wow, it flipped my mind. And I discover ecological economics. Imagine if the economy is a subsystem of the living world. Foundational concept. It blew me away. Somebody mentioned a book by a woman called Donella Meadows, Thinking in Systems. And I said, but what's that? And I went and read that. It totally blew my mind. And I thought, why wasn't I taught systems thinking? This is the most brilliant tool. So I started accumulating and assembling these amazing ideas, the work of Ellen Ostrom on the commons, that it's a triumph, not just a tragedy, just bringing together these amazing ideas, feminist economics. And I wanted to make them dance on the same page. I wanted to bring them together so that they became the foundations of a new mindset. Not that you had to either be a feminist economist going to all the feminist economics conferences and writing in the feminist economics journals and you're part of that community, or an ecological economist over here. But what happens when we bring them together and offer them not as many separate critiques of the mainstream, but as a new proposition for the whole? That was my goal in donut economics. So the theory is out there. It's been there for decades, right? Systems thinking, yeah. Donella Meadows was, as you well know, wrote in the 1970s, Herman Daly. So I wanted to celebrate all these ideas that have been around for a long time. Where was this going to get traction? And that's where I realized, you know, universities aren't even beginning to bring this into the curriculum because it's foundational. I think it's deeply challenging. When you say, take the model of the economy, the circular flow diagram that every undergraduate's taught as the biggest image of the economy that we have, it's completely missing any mention of the living world. What if we drew a circle around it and say it's contained within the living world? It's an open system within a closed system. That is totally transformative. So it's foundationally challenging. Ideas of being regenerative by design, circular economy, distributive by design, using systems thinking to think about the economy and complexity. I just saw that this is, you know, I wrote Donut Economics actually intending to make a call for universities to update the curriculum. That's what it was. It was my piece of advocacy as a frustrated economic student saying, what if these ideas were put at the heart of the curriculum? I actually got a pretty shut door response from universities. Meanwhile, I'm getting in contact with so many people who are just getting on and doing this. And they're like, yeah, I love donut economics. It basically brings together everything that I'm already doing. It wasn't a revelation to these folks. It was like, yeah, that's what we're doing. But you've actually now given us an overarching framework. I can now share it and explain it to other people what I'm doing. But they were actually putting it into practice. Here, look, yeah, we're creating cooperatives and associations. We're making sure they're regenerative by design, by using, you know, part of recycling and refurbishing materials. We're making them distributive by design because of the way we design. It just was second nature to these folks who were doing it. So I realized that rather than trying to persuade theorists to get on this, just hang out with the practitioners because they already get the theory. They are taking it forward in practice. And the front edge of this work is to be found in practice. It's going to take maybe even decades for the textbooks to catch up with where the practice is. So if you want to be at the cutting edge of it, you're not going to find it in journal articles. You are going to find it in the workshops, in the streets, in the organizations, in the minds and practices of people who are embodying it. That's why I say 21st century economics is going to be practice first and theorize later. One day the textbooks will catch up, but they are nowhere close yet.
Now, I fully agree with that as well. In fact, I think the latest survey by Rethinking Economics, looking at the curriculum in the UK, kind of speaks to that, right? Yeah. Most of the major universities, I think, including Oxford, Glasgow, up near where I'm from, not getting any of this yet into the curriculum, no ecological economics, not even much in the financial crisis. So I fully agree. And I agree with you as well. It seems to be that it's happening almost everywhere except the mainstream. You mentioned sort of businesses. I know there's been a lot of work done on cities. Can you talk a little bit more about what is implementation? What does doing the donut look like in some of the communities that you're working with?
Yeah. So when my book came out in 2017, I started doing book talks and speaking at festivals, and I did a rail trip around Germany and lots of presentations. And I was imagining I'll spend, you know, much of the rest of the year just presenting these ideas and trying to see if I can get any traction. And I was in fact thinking of doing a little roadshow, putting together a little theatre production and being very playful about donut economics on the stage and telling it as a story. What happened at these book talks was people would come up to me afterwards and say, I love these ideas. I'm actually putting it into practice. I'm a teacher. I've already introduced it in my classroom. I don't care that it's not in the curriculum. This is what the students should be learning. Or I've started it in my company. I've put it on the board table, and we're now meeting around this donut, and we're asking ourselves, how can our business help bring humanity into the donut? I'm a town councillor. I'm a mayor. Can we do this here? Do we have to wait for the whole world? Can we just get started doing this here? We're a community group. We want to bring this into our existing transition towns work, or we want to set up a group around it. I was blown away. I'm a games designer. I'm making a game about the donut. I'm a graffiti artist. It just blew me away, the number of people who were playing with it. So there was something very strong about the visual meme that was inspiring people. And I think, you know, economics either frightens or bores many people. But when you stick the word donut in front of it, everybody knows it's a bit playful and people get involved. One of the places that it's, people get involved. And so I was just overwhelmed by the number of people coming up to me saying, we want to do this. But as a single person, there was nothing I could do with that. I couldn't, it was just overwhelming. That's what made me realize I needed to set up an organization. In fact, one lovely person who organized my tour in Italy said to me, you have a responsibility for the legacy of this idea. And I thought, oh my goodness, I do. I need to set up an organization. And when I came up with the idea of it being an action lab, that sounded light enough and playful enough and exploratory enough that I thought I could do this. I'm going to find a co-founder. I found a brilliant co-founder, Carlotta Sands. We're still working together today. And we're 7 years on, the Donut Economics Action Lab. We exist to help connect and bring together and co-inspire and learn with practitioners who are putting donut economics into practice in education, in local government, in towns and cities around the world, in national governments, in different sectors from fashion to highways to tourism to healthcare, in community groups, so in academia. So we're working with practitioners who are showing up and saying, we want to do this. Brilliant. We'd love to connect you with other people like you, because there's nothing so inspiring as someone who's aiming to do that thing you're wanting to do. And look, they're already doing it. Let's make tools that we can use and we can share out with others. And let's see how we learn on this together. So that's the Action Lab. One of the areas where it's really had a lot of traction, I'd say, is with local governments around the world, often in cities, but sometimes in towns and rural districts. So in Oxfordshire, where I happen to live, in Amsterdam, in Ipoh, in Malaysia, in El Monte, in Chile, it's taken off, and local governments have taken the concept and said, what if we actually envision meeting the needs of all of our people within the means of the living planet? So living well here and making sure that we don't undermine the planet or the rest of humanity in the process of doing so. Can we use that as a tool for new vision for this place? Can we use it as a tool for assessing projects that we want to do? Can we measure our progress towards this goal over time? So they've created a portrait of the city or the county through the lenses of the donut. And now saying, you know, through to 2040, we're going to keep on measuring this. This becomes our primary accountability, not what's the GDP of the city, but rather, are we beginning to meet the needs of all people? Are we coming back within the means of the living planet? So it's being adopted now by over 50 towns, cities, counties, districts around the world by the local government. They've actually publicly placed it in the heart of their plan. There's at least another 50 who are engaging and exploring it behind the scenes. So we know that it's become a really valuable tool amongst these policymakers. And now it's starting in national government, policymakers in national governmental situations, civil servants. We've made a tool for governmental policymakers that's online that they can see all of the 7 ways to think, to be regenerative by design, be distributive by design, using systems thinking, nurturing human nature. Here are policies all around the world that we think reflect those aspirations. So we're really trying to take the concepts and show, look, there are policies and practices all around the world already that are bringing these to life.
Yeah, and I'm happy to say that in Vienna, where I am based, we are also moving finally in that direction.
Yeah.
So, and thanks a lot. Yeah, to the, like you say, to the fact that you can see other cities doing it. So it also, I think, takes away a lot of that barrier. We've got the first movers out there. My experience as well is that the people in the city are often ready, and maybe even further than the politicians.
Right.
But I have, you know, I have also experienced in that kind of the background conversations that I'm having where that works, and then sometimes maybe where it doesn't work. I was talking to one city, I won't mention the name. In this case, it was a politician really keen to take the donut, work with it, gets it into the civil service, and then the economics department, which in this case seem to be full of kind of more old guard, kind of neoclassical economists, probably tending male and not really wanting to or willing to sort of work with it. And then it got, as I understand in this case, kind of kicked down the ranks until it luckily ended with a junior, in this case, female economist, who did pick it up. And then the city did move with it. But there was that kind of internal resistance. I don't know, have you experienced that?
Well, that sounds very familiar. And I think it's a really great example to remind all of us that institutions are not homogeneous. People could say, the city council said, or, you know, the city council is made up of many departments, within each one, many people who may have different opinions. So within every organization, there are different groups. And in every case, when the donut's been adopted, it's because someone, maybe one or two people, and they're always identifiable, has said, I think this is a great idea for this place right now. They've brought it in. They've got a conviction to try and make this happen. They then need to persuade their colleagues. If it's going to be formally adopted by the city, it's going to have to pass the city council with a majority vote, right? So first, that's the first job. And of course, there are going to be people who say, what is this? Donuts? What are you talking about? Or, you know, oh, is this too radical? Or so you're going to face some challenge there. And yet there are brilliant councillors or mayors who've said, come on, let's do this. And they've persuaded their colleagues. But then once you've got the concept adopted, as you say, it might then run into the economics department, who are going to look at it through an old economics lens, if that's where they're coming from, and just say, what is this? This doesn't make sense. This is far too normative. This isn't positive. We've already got all the tools we need. And even if you don't have these problems, you're going to have elections at some point. What happens if those politicians don't get reelected? What happens if the key civil servant who was really holding the idea moves on and gets rotated into another position? So any idea trying to take root is going to face these challenges of change. What I have seen, I would say, is that the places where it's had the strongest traction, and there are places where it's, you know, still in use after 5, 6, 7 years, that you've got both an elected politician who's a champion of it and speaking publicly about it, that you've got civil servants, some people within the civil servant who are remaining there, holding it and bringing it into the civil service and making sense of it. And then you've also got some kind of community mobilization, clear public support for this. When you have those three tiers, I think it's got far greater chance of surviving, and surviving political change, surviving, you know, new events, new ideas coming along. And of course, there may seem to be tension between those groups. They may often seem to be in tension, but actually they're somehow holding each other in accountability and holding each other in the game. So yes, adopting a new idea, bringing, you know, introducing a new paradigm, really challenging work, as Donella Meadows always said, or as Thomas Kuhn always said. This is how we start to make it happen. And that's why we call ourselves an action lab. We don't know how this is going to work. We're going with the practitioners. We are following the energy. Let's see what we learn about the challenges that they're encountering as they go.
Yeah, it seems to me that the public perception, in fact, I think there was a study recently of UK business people conducted in cooperation with London School of Economics, where it was a large percent of business leaders in favour of the donut as a goal, but they underestimated their colleagues' or their peers' support for it.
That's right. I've got it on my desktop. It's called The Hidden Business Majority. They found that 86% of business professionals in the UK support post-growth business principles, but believe that only 53% of their peers do. And over 90% of the people interviewed believe businesses should follow donut economics principles. I was blown away by this when it came out. It's incredible. We hadn't had any interaction with them beforehand. They just came out with this survey. So, and I think it's a beautiful example that when you ask people, what do you think? The people say, yeah, I think we should be following the principles that our business should be aligned with, meeting the needs of all within the means of the planet. We should seek to be regenerative by design and distributive by design. But we often don't believe that those around us are ready. So we're all systematically underestimating the readiness of everybody else. That's a really important insight. Other surveys have found this too. But also there's a difference between people and the values and their full understanding of the world as full human beings versus what they feel they can do or the incentives that they face as a business person. in their role, in their role of reporting on their quarterly reports and showing that they're, you know, delivering a growing margin, growing profits, growing market share every quarter. So again, this highlights the distinction between what the whole human senses and realizes needed versus the institutions that we've inherited that are designed for very, very narrow boundary thinking, for profit maximization. And that's why actually donut economics for businesses, I think, is a tall order, right? For companies, it's tough mm-hmm. because if those companies are, whether they're privately owned or shareholder owned, if they are designed in their purpose, their networks of relationships, how they're governed, how they're owned, and how they're financed, if they're designed for maximizing profit, which is a very typical business design. I mean, what else are we in business for? But if they're designed for that, it's going to make them very difficult. It's going to make it very difficult for them to prioritize something else, which is being yeah. regenerative and distributive by design, helping become a business as a vehicle for meeting the needs of all people within the means of the planet. So I think we're going to find that many of the businesses that are prevalent today that are designed on a very, very 20th century shareholder maximizing value return model, they, I believe, are not the vehicle that's going to take business forward in the 21st century. We need different kinds of businesses. So it's a big jump, and maybe a too much of a jump. I think some companies won't be able to make it because they are so designed to maximize shareholder returns. It's just too much of a pivot to actually say, we're going to deliver sufficient shareholder returns, we're going to deliver some kind of return, but actually our priority is our purpose. We need different businesses to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see, you know, and that tool is fantastic as well. I encourage everyone to look at it. We're also using it in work in Vienna, you know, for new businesses or younger businesses or businesses that are maybe not, you know, these huge organizations with their, as you said, quarterly reporting and their shareholders, those that have more flexibility. But it's those big organizations. And it's also, I mean, you mentioned, I guess, the institutional part of it. So I think that's where I struggle a little bit, because I can see on the one hand, more and more people at an individual level are stepping out of the system, right, and trying to do something different and building up communities of practice, whether it's around donut economics or well-being economy, which is all fantastic. And then I see at the institutional level, sometimes things actually shifting away from where we need them to go. Like if we take, as you mentioned, the profit orientation, which is written into the DNA of our economies, it's written even into the way that our finance system works, that we have governments that are still prioritizing, you know, finance, which requires returns, and pensions that require these high returns. So I'm thinking that it's at that institutional level where we still have decision makers with these, you know, with these old models, right? So I don't know what you think about this. You know, I've been talking to lots of people about what we need to do, because I'm still, I mean, I do agree with the practice part of it. I still, that the parent in me, I have three children in high school. I don't want them to get this understanding yeah. of the economy, this yeah. market understanding. And it does influence our decision makers. We've been talking to some people, say, okay, you just need to bypass the universities. You just need to go straight to the decision makers. But we still do have a lot of decision makers in key roles, kind of upholding the systems. Do you see a way there that we can move forward? Do we need to be talking more about the economics as a discipline? Like, it's really time to move on? Or, you know, as you mentioned before, can we afford a couple of decades to wait before the textbooks change, I guess, would be my question to you.
No, we can't afford that. And it's actually the one thing I notice whenever I'm thinking about these issues, is the one place I get angry. I get really deeply, deeply frustrated that there's a generation of young people coming to university every year, and they sign up to study economics. And in this country, they take out a big loan and they dedicate 3 years of their life to studying a subject. They think, and what upsets me is some of them say, I read donut economics, I was so excited, so I went to university to study economics, but they're teaching me everything that you said was the old way. I've heard that so many times. We cannot give up on the universities. Young people today, born into polycrisis, hearing it on the news all the time. I mean, my own children are now 17. So they are now thinking, what do I want to study at university? I mean, the idea that they would study that old system and peers of theirs will study it really makes me mad. These are going to be the people who are taking the world through the 21st century. They deserve a mindset. They deserve ways of thinking, systems thinking, ecological basis for economics. They deserve to be given the foundations so that they can come up with the really challenging policies that lie ahead. I mean, our generation are not giving them the policies, but at least let's give them the mindset of foundations that so that they have even half a chance of creating the kinds of policies that are going to be needed. So we cannot give up on the universities. But I would say rather than thrashing away and trying to convert mainstream economics departments, I would just say, where are the courses that you can do? And people have started mapping, where are the ecological economics courses? Where are the courses in systems thinking? So go to where they are already being embraced. And I would just say, go and study there. What I can't bear is that students sign up, go to a mainstream university, and they say, well, I raise my hand and I always ask, what about the sustainability angle? And the professor says, I'm so glad you're asking that question. I am so fed up of them being used to ask that question. This should be in the curriculum. They shouldn't have to be the one who asks it from the back of the room every time. And other students roll their eyes. Oh, here they come with the environment question again. It's just so way past the time.
Yeah.
So we have to change economic thinking, and students just move away from those mainstream degrees. And thank goodness for rethinking economics that are, you know, from within, right? The power of the students from within, assessing these curricula and saying, you are not teaching us what we want to be taught. I don't know any other discipline where the students turn up ready to study for 3-4 years and then realize the first thing they have to do is dedicate their hours to actually lobbying to change the very curriculum they're going to be studying while paying for the loan to do this at the same time. I don't know any other discipline that has this going on. And it's been going on for many years now. And of course, there's a massive disadvantage of the students because the students have got 3 years and the professor's got tenure. So that's not equal. The student, they'll just be the turnover and then the next bunch turn up. So where I live in Oxford, every year there's a new clutch of students come in and say, would you come and teach down at economics? And we want you to come and give a lecture in the evening because it's not on the curriculum. So I'm being asked to come in again and again and again outside of the curriculum to bring in the thing that they say they actually want to be taught. I should add in here, of course, not all students want to be taught this. And I think economics brings together a particularly divergent group of people. Some study economics because they want to join the system. They want to be part of it. Teach me the skills. Mm. Teach me the mainstream language. I want to conform and become part of that system and I'll benefit from it. And others don't want to conform. They want to transform. They want to be taught a totally different mindset. They want to challenge the fundamentals of today's economy. So you've got those students sitting side by side. Now, most universities are graded, let's say the business school or the university are graded, ranked against each other. What are the criteria for ranking? The starting salary of your graduates. So guess which one they're going to lean towards. Are we going to lean towards teaching and satisfying those who want to conform with the system because the system will pay them a lot of money? Or are we going to teach those who want to transform the system where the jobs are actually few and far between and actually more precarious at the moment because it hasn't got established? So there's an inherent lean of business schools particularly towards the mainstream because that will get them the ranking. So it all goes back to the incentives of their institutions that we are part of. So we need to change the university degrees. At the same time, we can't sit and wait for that. That would be deeply irresponsible to say, well, just start with the next generation and let this generation carry on with the same old thinking. My personal approach is to go where the energy is because I don't have the stamina or the willingness to spend my life banging on shut doors. I am far more energized to keep doing this work if I'm working with people who get it, who are doing it, who've adopted it, and can demonstrate it in practice. And this is where I turn to Milton Friedman, right? He said, Milton Friedman, the bad boy of neoliberal economics, who from the 1940s was part of the Mont Pelerin Society that wanted to make neoliberalism the new way of doing things, and they succeeded, so we should listen to them. Milton Friedman said, almost word for word, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. And then he goes on, he says, this, I believe, is our basic function, to make sure that to develop alternative policies, make sure that they're existing and available until the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable. So when a crisis occurs, people turn to the ideas that are lying around. They can be lying around in a book. Margaret Thatcher famously pulled Hayek's book out of her handbag. Mm-hmm. Or why just leave them lying around? Why not have them up and running? And that's what we're doing at Donut Economics Action Lab. Why not actually work with people who are ready to do this now, who get it and are in a context and have an opportunity to actually start putting this policy into practice, so we can say, oh, you want to run a local government on distributive and regenerative policies? Here we are. Here's one we can point to in Malaysia that are seeking to do that. Here's one in Amsterdam. Here's one in Sweden in a small town. Here's one in Chile. We're just showing you this is already happening. This is already normal in some places. I think there's nothing so compelling as seeing people doing what you thought was impossible, already getting on with it. As Amelia Earhart, the incredible aviator, said, never interrupt somebody doing what you said couldn't be done. So let's work with these folks. Let's give them space and let's amplify what they're doing. So yes, we need to change the university curriculum. And of course, what we want to do in the curriculum is teach them the concepts of donut economics and then point them to the places that are already putting it into practice. So they see that this theory is not idealistic and utopian. It's actually in practice in places. And then they can feel a conviction that I'm actually learning skills for an economy that is emergent, and I'm determined to work in that new economy, not be sucked back in to the old ways of the old economy and told to put my youthful ideas aside and get back to business of maximizing returns for shareholders. See how it makes me mad?
Oh, don't worry. I get very mad. It's nice to actually hear someone else getting mad, so I don't feel like I'm alone screaming yeah. into my pillow about mainstream economics. But no, I agree. And I also wanted to say, I do also work with donut economics. I've also been asked to teach actually at a business school, but at a business school that is outside of the main city, small, doing innovative work around green businesses. And one of the theories that I have, I think, is that donut economics will come into practice kind of everywhere except in the mainstream departments. And if we just have enough of these alternatives out there, we'll soon be just bypassing them completely and giving people the opportunity to do it differently.
And I am going to agree with you on that. And I have to say that donut economics has been picked up a lot in universities.
Yeah.
It's just mostly in, and sometimes in business schools, because business schools have their feet in the ground. They have supply chains. They need water. They employ people, right? They're hit by energy crisis. They are in the real material climate changing world. So it's relevant. But it's picked up in urban studies. It's picked up a lot in architecture, in health, in civil engineering. I know young people who've gone off to university and sent me photographs from their courses all around the world in totally different disciplines. Oh, we're being taught the donut. It's less than anything else I know picked up in mainstream economics departments, because it's just a very different paradigm. And this is the one thing that makes me mad about mainstream economics, is that it very often fails to make its own students aware that there are many schools of thought. I think it's a right of an economic student to know that there are many schools of thought. There's ecological economics, and then there's environmental economics. Yes, these are different. There's neoclassical economics, but there's Marxian economics. There's feminist economics. There's complexity economics. There's behavioral economics. There's institutional economics. Now, we're going to respect you so much, young people, that we're going to show you something of all of these ways of thinking and leave it up to your own critical faculties to decide which one you think is most useful for analysing a particular aspect of the world. And one of the things I love is that a website that's called Exploring Economics, set up by the network economy in Germany. So it's a kind of very related to Rethink Economics. And they set up this website. You go on it. And it just has a little box for each of the kinds of schools of thought I just mentioned. And it gives you a one line and a one paragraph and an in-depth. It goes as in-depth as you want with each of these schools of thought. I think every economics professor should stand on the first day of the term and the first of their lectures with this whole array of all the schools of thought on the board, and then point to the ones that they are speaking from, so that we make explicit, oh, I'm speaking about neoclassical economics and behavioral economics, or I'm here as an ecological economist and a feminist economist, so that we can start to see that we're being taught from a spectrum of worldviews. And any textbook that's called economics is either hiding the fact from you that it's kind of neoclassical economics, didn't need to say it because it's so predominant, who needs to name it, or its practitioners, its economists are just unaware there's such an array of ways of thinking that they have a very particular worldview, that they're coming from somewhere. I remember when my book came out in the Netherlands, some Dutch journalist wanted me in conversation with a mainstream economist. And I put the donut on the table, and this economist said, ah, but you see, when you come with all these human needs and the environmental values, now you've lost your objectivity as an economist. You see, you've gone political. And I said, wow, do you not even realise that all of your theories sitting inside every model from rational economic man to the absence of the living world to the taking initial income distribution is given, do you not realise that there are values packed into everything you're doing? Now I'm afraid of you because at least I'm making my values really explicit and we can have a conversation about it. But your values are so packed away inside the theories, they look objective because it all turns into an equation, that you're not even able to discuss the values you're speaking from because they're hidden, and that is disturbing.
Mm. Yes, and positive economics invented by our friend Milton Friedman, I learned recently as well.
Yes.
So there's a, yeah. I want to be careful about your time. This was really wonderful. And I think we've gone further than I expected to. I did want to just wrap up by asking what you're working on now. And you mentioned before that you said you wish you had turned this into theatre, but you are actually doing theatre, and I don't know very much about it, and I'd really be interested. I think it was at the Donut Circus. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Yeah. You're right, and you just connected those two things. So when my book first came out, I wanted to do some very playful presentations, and I even sat down with a set designer one day in a cafe, and we started drawing, you know, what if we brought Rational Economic Man on stage, and how could you show regenerative design? And I started getting very playful, and then I literally closed that little book and put it aside on my bookshelves because I started getting drawn in by the practitioners and realizing I need to create an organization. I found that little notebook only recently. It's like, wow, I really started on this line. It's come back in a different form. One of the things I love doing is presentations at book festivals and summer festivals in the UK. And they often have a tent of big ideas and book festivals. And so I was giving a talk at a festival a couple of years ago. And I said, the talk's half an hour. It's called We Need to Talk About Growth. I won't use any slides. I'll be in a festival site and I'll just use some objects and see how it goes. And I went to check out the site the night before of where I'd be speaking. And it was a circus tent. Everybody's sitting around in circles on hay bales and string bunting hanging from the. And I thought, my God, I'm in a circus tent. I have to deserve this space. I have to be as playful as the space. So I was much more playful and interactive with the audience. And I called someone up onto the stage and talking about growth. And at the end of it, lots of people just came up to me and said, that was great. Even my six-year-old, she didn't understand everything you said, but you totally had her attention. And I realized I had a lot of fun and people were laughing and I was laughing. So I thought, what was that? And I then enrolled to go on a clowning course. I went to some improv classes. And then the next festival I did, I really took along a lot of objects. And I've learned that if you invite someone up on the stage to come and play, whether the Chancellor of the Exchequer or to come and play growth or to come and play finance and the loan sharks, if you give them a hat, they feel masked and they feel freer to be a character. If you give them an object, like a bag, like the Chancellor's red tax box saying tax on it, or a shark for a loan shark, or a noodle, swimming noodle, so we can make some graphs with swimming noodles. If you give them an object, they feel safe to play. And I've been blown away. So I now do circuses. I did one called We Need to Talk About Growth. My current circus is called Battle for the Biosphere, Nature versus Finance. The next circus is going to be called How Rich is Too Much. So bringing together some of the big issues of the day into the big top in a very playful way. Here's why I love it. One, people come as their whole selves and they come playfully and they step into a space that's clearly like a circus. So we're not there in suits. We're not there in our name badges. We're not in a corporate or academic atmosphere. We bring our whole selves and we bring our humor. And there's something very powerful about humor. It means we can talk about really big, deep, challenging political power issues in a playful way with a laugh. We can talk about it now. We often can't actually talk about it when we talk straight. So humor makes taboo things permissible. But the thing I really love is the extraordinary willingness of people who at one moment think I'm the audience and I'm watching this. And before they know it, I've said, has anybody ever wanted to be a clown? I need a clown to come and blow a bubble. Suddenly their hand is up and they're up on the stage and they're being Bobo the clown. I've put a hat and a red nose on them and they're blowing a bubble to symbolize the biosphere. The hilarity, the wit, the playfulness, the on-the-spot responses I get from people. Somebody comes and play nature. Somebody plays finance. We bring up the emotions of finance on the stage. These folks didn't know it. People often say to me afterwards, no, but surely they all knew you planted them. And that guy who came and did juggling and the person who came and did that incredibly bendy act, none of them knew. And I didn't know any of them. So it's revealed to me the incredible creativity, playfulness, courage of humans. And I say at the end of the circus, we just created a circus together from scratch. So we had all the skills already here in the tent. Who knew? So what else can we do? And I'm going to go back to that statistic you mentioned earlier, right? Many of us want a different kind of economy, different kind of business, but we believe that only half the number of people that actually want it are really ready as well. We massively underestimate ourselves and everybody around us. So the circus shows us we're ready to do something way more creative, way more playful, way more fun, and way more memorable. That's why I'm loving doing circus.
That sounds wonderful. I know some clowns. I am really inspired to do something like that where I am. I'll follow up with you on that.
Great.
Thank you, Kate. Final question. Do you have any feedback for us on what we're trying to do with this project?
What are you trying to do with this project?
We're trying to reclaim economics. Our title is Invisible Handcuffs. We're trying to make seen the handcuffs that are capturing our imagination, preventing us from, you know, getting past that statistic you mentioned. So we're going out, we're trying to talk to as many people as will talk to us to help show both where economics is going wrong, but also where, you know, what we can do to get out of these handcuffs.
So having named Invisible Handcuffs, of course, your task is to make them visible, which I think you're doing.
Yes.
One part of making that visible is making visible the mindset that we are inculcated into and caught in. But I think the other part of those handcuffs is the incentives and the institutional structures. And the more that you can help make those visible. So I mentioned one, which is the world's business schools are ranked on the starting salary of their graduates. So guess what they're going to be trained to do? They're going to be trained to go into today's high profit businesses. So that incentive system trickles right down to whether or not the donut will come into your lecture. And once I think we become aware of that, then that mobilizes. I mean, I think it mobilizes students. It mobilizes all of us. So this is insane. I'll give you another example. People often say, you know, with kind of paradigm change, oh, we'll change paradigm one funeral at a time. Not so sure. Actually, some of the older professors, the ones who are long tenured, are freest to pursue what they believe. And they actually can be some of the more radical ones. When my book came out in Belgium, I did a roundtable conversation with about 12 mainstream economists. We had a really good conversation, and over coffee, away from everybody else, a young lecturer came up to me. He was associate professor, and he said, he was about in his mid-30s, and he said, I love the ideas of donut economics. I would love to be teaching them to my students, but I'm on track to get tenure, so I have to be cautious. And I thought, wow, that was the one thing I remember from that whole trip. This professor gets the ideas. There's nothing between him and the mindset that I'm talking about. He wants to teach it in his classroom. I believe those students would love it, but he's on track to get tenure. And so he now needs to get the approval of all those professors, and he needs to publish in those journals. And again, he's locked into that old incentive system, and that is stopping him from. So his need for his personal advancement in his career as an academic economist, as a research economist, is blocking him from teaching what this current generation have come to university to learn and what will equip them for a future that they face. So the more that you can make the incentives and the institutional design visible of those invisible handcuffs, I think they'll make us so frustrated we will break free and demand that these institutions be changed, or we realign around other institutions, walk away from the departments that are stuck in these old ways and coalesce around different kinds of degrees and different kinds of thinking that is already alive and bubbling there. So I think if you can make that visible, you will help us burst out of these invisible handcuffs.
Thank you, Kate. We'll do our best. Thank you so much once again for everything you're doing and for talking with us today. And yeah, please keep going.
My pleasure. And you guys, you keep going. Here's to this podcast, Katie. You know, I'm a massive fan of the three-part podcast you put together on the limits to growth. I mean, that just blew me away listening to that. So I'm so thrilled that you're now podcasting and in conversation with people, not using found archive tape from the 1970s, but people who are alive today, and you're able to be in conversation with all of us and bring that story. Your storytelling techniques are fabulous. So I can't wait to see what you make with all of it.
Thank you very much, Kate.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Invisible Handcuffs, Unchaining Economics, hosted by me, Katie Shields, with music, art and production by Philip Melchers. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider liking and following us on YouTube or your favourite podcasting platform, and by subscribing on our website at invisiblehandcuffs.com, where you can also find the show notes to this episode and more about the project. With that, thank you for listening, and I hope to see you next time.